Welcome. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and you're listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. As the impact of COVID continues to affect many Americans, one population is seeing an uptick in threats. Asian Americans are experiencing a higher rate of racism and xenophobia since the pandemic shut down the economy back in March. Joining me today is Helen Hsu, psychologist, Asian American specialist, and lecturer at Stanford University. Helen, thank you so much for joining me today.
Glad to be here.
Well, what have you seen in Asian American communities in the last several months, 6 months, I guess it is, since the coronavirus spawned this pandemic?
Well, definitely in these last few months, there's been a nationwide increase in reported incidents of anti-Asian harassment and hate crimes. And so you can see across multiple communities that there's been an increase in a level of stress and anxiety and anger on top of the pandemic stress that we're all dealing with.
Have you actually seen patients who have come to you regarding this issue?
We definitely actually already had seen clients who had dealt with racist incidents and harassment even before COVID-19, but the escalation jumped quite a bit after the blame was being targeted toward China. And so Dr. Russell Jiang at San Francisco State University actually started a database where people could report incidents. And so there has clearly been an increase. And yes, we've definitely felt it, not only clients who've experienced it, but unfortunately what hateful climate and speech does is it creates anxiety and fear even for people who have not yet experienced it.
Right. You know, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights issued a statement expressing grave concern regarding growing anti-Asian racism and xenophobia related to the coronavirus pandemic. Mm-hmm. And they suggested using terminology such as a Chinese coronavirus or Kung flu or Wuhan flu was fueling xenophobic animosity towards Asian Americans. And even with that statement, President Donald Trump doubled down.
There's never been anything where they have so many names. I could give you 19 or 20 names for that, right? It's got all different names. Wuhan. Now, Wuhan was catching on. Coronavirus, right? Kung flu, yeah. Kung flu. COVID-19, COVID. I say, what's the 19? COVID-19, some people can't explain what the 19.
Do you believe using racist language to describe this pandemic has contributed to the instigation of race-based assaults?
It clearly has. And the United States has a long history of conflating, you know, political things or things going on in society with race. With terrible consequences, right? Like the internment of Japanese Americans when the Japanese government had attacked Pearl Harbor, and this has nothing to do with Japanese Americans. You know, hate crimes that have been exacerbated due to economic reasons. And so often conflating immigrants with this idea of disease, this has been going on since the 1800s. So this kind of pattern isn't new, of blaming something like race, which is an incredibly broad category, and confusing Asian Americans with international Asians, which has nothing to do with anything either, but that it actually increases negativity, attacks. And so there have been a long history of this in US history.
Yeah, and I can understand, to be honest, for me, I'm Asian American myself. I've been self-quarantining with my family because I'm with my kids and their grandparents, my in-laws. Mm-hmm. So I haven't felt the anxiety being out and about and maybe being looked at. Mm-hmm. But I can understand, you know, vicariously, I can see based on what I've seen in the news how scary that can be for other people of Asian descent. You know, besides avoiding racially based language, what can people of all backgrounds and even government officials be doing to stem this xenophobia? Is there anything they can do?
Well, I think some of the more responsible government officials have really emphasized that they are not going to use any race-baiting language, that, you know, the COVID-19 response should focus on health and public health. that regardless of, and it's controversial even exactly necessarily about the etiology of the disease, but or the virus, but regardless of etiology, we have to have a public health response. And so blaming a broad racial group does nothing to actually help us like cooperate and figure out what needs to be done in terms of health.
Mm-hmm.
And also protecting vulnerable populations that, you know, this is really about protecting the health of elders and immunocompromised people, you know, and it's an interesting intersection of different kinds of isms and harassment that, for example, on Dr. Jiang's Stop AAPI Hate reporting website, I thought it was really kind of sad and funny that he had noted that they immediately notice a pattern, right, that the intersectionality of harassment, that women were more than two times more likely to be harassed than others, which didn't surprise me much as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
But vulnerable populations, like at least 11% of the people reporting harassment were young. They were youth. They were minors.
Wow.
7.7% were elders, so vulnerable people. And that 60% of those harassed were not Chinese, right? And so it's the way that this extremely broad paintbrush of all Asians, Asian immigrants, international students, Asian Americans just get confused by this kind of language.
I guess what I have realized in, you know, seeking help for myself, you know, as an Asian American, I've dealt with, you know, the stigma, you know, in my family around mental mm-hmm. illness, been with this trauma, inflicting this community, mm-hmm. you know, firsthand as well as vicariously. How will these xenophobic threats affect one's mental health if not treated?
The big concern is that, and there was an article recently about how for a lot of Asian Americans, it feels like they're dealing with this extra layer of stress and increased anxiety, concerns for safety, you know, real impact on Asian businesses. There were people who were boycotting, you know.
Oh,
so just this all around every aspect of life, you know, maybe being concerned for your child or for your elder to go out. And so chronic stress in general has huge mental and physical impacts. And everyone is experiencing chronic stress right now with the pandemic. And so adding on this other layer for Asian Americans is extremely impactful on all aspects of health.
It's interesting because it's not like this group of people who are being attacked by others, placing blame on Asian Americans. They're not excluded from the virus itself. Just wondering, as far as Asian Americans are concerned, when it comes to the mental aspects of it, how does it affect their behaviors towards others? Or even, you know, do you feel like it could isolate people? Because I mean, maybe, you know, I'm isolating, obviously, because I'm quarantining. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that maybe that's an excuse for me not to be out there and you know, avoiding any type of harassment as such. Do you think that, you know, these actions, this can change a person's behavior and how they move through the world and their community?
It definitely has. And of course, it varies on where you live, but not a lot. Like, a lot of the reports of hate have even happened in extremely diverse communities, such as the San Francisco Bay Area, where I'm at. So people have reported things like feeling anxious just going to the grocery store, or feeling like they can't just go out for a run in the neighborhood because they could be targeted now. And so there is an emotional health impact. And, you know, Dr. Gordon Nagioma Hall has published, been quoted in an article, really also pointing out that sometimes microaggressions and ignorance, you know, even can take place in professional settings and including with mental health, because there, you know, are not that many AAPI mental health providers, and not that you have to see another Asian American provider for matching, but it's hard to find someone who actually understands these very complex issues, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then there are great providers who are not AAPI, but you'd have to screen out like who actually is culturally responsive and has that kind of training to understand social context in relation to mental health.
That is interesting. I know in my first episode on racial trauma, African Americans and Black Americans are have an issue, especially with the social unrest, finding a provider who understands their plight. And I was just thinking about this as far as like Asian Americans and receiving proper care from, you know, people who can kind of empathize with their personal experience. Do you think you said that this is kind of a struggle for Asian Americans. Do you think that there needs to be a change in the landscape of the mental health care system to make it diverse for the diversity of its patients?
Very clearly, there's been research indicating that, yes, the mental health field is overly white, Western, philosophically centered, that those values simply don't work well for, honestly, the majority of people on earth are not of that perspective, right? I often remind my students that the majority of people on earth do come from collectivist societies with different, maybe family, multi-generational families, different ideas about boundaries, values. So it's important to have therapists who actually understand something about that. I mean, none of us will know everything, but to be able to treat people in a culturally responsive, respectful manner. Because the last thing, say, a Black, Indigenous, or Asian or Latinx client needs to do is be taking up their own therapy time, doing emotional labor, educating their therapist. Or it's unfortunately happened often that a therapist will do a microaggression or say something because of, you know, lack of knowledge or stereotypes. So it is an ongoing problem. We talk a lot in our field about recruitment, retention of more diverse clinicians, you know, and this is, again, intersectional, right? We definitely need more people who understand disabled experiences, disability, LGBTQ experiences. Mm-hmm. Economic experiences that unfortunately historically we have had therapists who don't understand different economic experiences because it's expensive to go to graduate school.
Yes.
So all these factors and the fact that a lot of what's invested in good mental health research doesn't go to our diverse communities, that we are about 6% of the U.S. population as Asian American Pacific Islanders, and we get something like below 2% of research funding. Mm. So all of this impacts ultimately what kind of care a person can find easily.
Wow. Are there programs that are pushing to create a more diverse healthcare, especially in the mental healthcare space? Are there programs that encourage it?
They're fairly minimal. Like, they're hard to get. For example, I'm a mentor with the American Psychological Association Minority Fellowship Program. And they give fellowships and provide mentoring, and it's absolutely wonderful. But it's small, you know, because of funding. So it's quite competitive. But they do have that for master's level as well as doctoral level, multicultural scholars of all kinds. And sometimes there's things like loan forgiveness. I think I got a little bit of loan forgiveness the first few years I came out of graduate school because I was working in an extremely underserved, very low income immigrant community in Oakland. And so there are programs such as that that help people with the costs. And there are organizations such as, you know, Association of Black Psychologists, Asian American Psychological Association, various groups of cultural community associations that try to help support students because it's a very difficult process.
There is this ideal in many Asian cultures about belonging and perfectionism. How do those ideas along with these threats affect their perception of themselves?
Definitely, there are aspects of some Asian cultures about perfectionism, about enduring things in a very stoic way, and that can be very psychologically burdensome over mm-hmm. time, especially as the sense of like anxiety or fear or stress from multiple angles is quite cumulative. One of the most common microaggressions harassment that a lot of AAPIs talk about experiencing is being treated, for example, like a perpetual foreigner, right? That you could be a third or fourth generation American and someone's treating you like a foreigner and, you know, blaming you for something in a country that you've never been to in your whole life. And So that really gets at identity and belonging, which can be extremely stressful, except especially for someone who may, for example, be young and still developing their identity.
Mm-hmm.
So all these factors, and then the cultural ways that we tend not to share about our struggles. So there have been very public campaigns with Asian American celebrities and like prominent people really speaking out against this kind of race baiting xenophobia. And I think that is helpful because in the past, I think culturally we often just hide things in a stoic way that actually is very detrimental to long-term mental health.
Yeah, I agree. You know, my family, like I mentioned, I tried to seek help so many times when I was much younger. Mm-hmm. At the age of 13, I was like, I need to see somebody. Something is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And my family just brushed it off. You know, if you don't think about it, it'll go away. There's no reason for this. You know, my mom worked in the medical field.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things she would mention to me is that she was worried that someone she knows would see me and that I think would bother her to a point where, no, I couldn't see a therapist. And obviously it created a lot of mental strife on my part. I as soon as I turned 18, I needed to find a therapist. It was extremely important to me. And so that was very frustrating. And, you know, for someone, you know, I was born in Jacksonville, Florida. Mm-hmm. I'm Filipino. There are a lot of Filipinos in the area because of the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I lived in an area where they were mostly, you know, I lived in Jacksonville Beach and most of the other Filipinos in the community lived in the city more. Honestly, growing up as a young child, I didn't realize like, oh, I'm different from the next person. But then as I went to high school and I moved to a school that was in the city, I was around all these Filipino kids and I didn't realize how different I was until I was around people who looked more like me. And I did feel a little like an outcast because a lot of my friends that I did have were, you know, white. And I just remember being bullied by a lot of the other Filipinos who were like, oh, you know, Lori Lee and her white friends. And mm-hmm. and that was kind of hurtful. And I think that's when I realized like I was different. And I, you know, I think that did also have a mental impact for me.
Yeah. I mean, identity development, getting that sense of being grounded in what you're about and where you belong is so important for teens and young adults. I mean, it's lifelong, but especially at that age, and it's very confusing. And as Asian Americans, there's so many different ways to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you may feel like you don't fit in into the very Asian community or this spiritual community or something. It's going to judge you in these ways. But then you're not white. And so, you know, are you a 0.5 generation or first gen, a third gen? You know, where do you live? So all of these things play in. And do you, and so people will talk about struggling with belongingness sometimes in every place. And that's a very unique problem that, for example, Asians growing up in a monoculture don't have to even think about. And so for a young person, especially who isn't really sure where they stand and is going through experiences, to also have outside influences, basically, you know, harassing you, telling you you don't belong where you know you have belonging, it's extremely stressful. And a lot of times, actually, because I am at Stanford, one of the saddest things that I see are we get a lot of 18-year-olds who are like, I've been waiting to go to therapy. And finally, I can now, and I love being able to be a part of that. But it's really sad to me that often their own families denied care or downplayed their pain. And it's usually out of fear and ignorance, not malice, right? It's right. Wishful thinking or being scared. I mean, I used to work with parents a lot, so I see their end. Being really scared, what is mental health? A lot of our immigrant parents come from countries that do not have confidentiality laws.
Mm.
So that's really important that I've talked with families who had been like, nope, 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 not going to counseling. You know, and sometimes when I've explained, like, do you understand that in counseling here, you know, barring these emergency situations or abuse situations, nothing else can be shared with anybody. Like, I could go to jail or pay thousands of dollars. And then it's like, oh, well, that's different.
No, I understand that, you know, I was upset, you know, when my, you know, I told my husband, I was like, I'm pretty upset that my mom really refused to let me get help. Looking at it from an outside perspective, he said, well, you know, maybe she didn't know what was going to happen to you. Maybe she thought you would be taken away from her, you know, and, and I didn't think about that because, you know, she is, you know, she came to America in the 70s. And so, you know, she didn't know exactly
how this works.
So I guess, and even that was like the 90s. So I mean, who really knew much about mental health at that point, you know, especially from someone who came from another country where mental health is really not talked about.
Yeah, as one of my Filipino extended family members, one of the young people had talked to me, and they were angry. They said, you know, my mom's in the medical field, she's a nurse, but when I asked for help for mental health, I was like, Auntie Helen, can you believe she just told me to pray?
Yeah, like, that sounds
amazing. Right. And it's like, I get it. That's what she knows. And I always tell parents, like, listen, you don't have to know how all this works, but you can find out.
Right.
You know, I think it's important to let family members, people you love, know that even if you don't understand, you're willing to go on this journey to help them seek what kind of support or resources they need. I've talked to parents who are like, I don't understand, say, depression or anxiety disorder or trauma flashbacks because I haven't had that experience, but I'm willing to learn.
Right.
Learn together, and I'm willing to take my kid or my family member to seek support and just see how it goes.
Well, what do you do when you, so if there is a parent who actually comes to you and says, you know, I don't understand any of this. I don't understand anything about mental health. They just seem sad all the time. I feel like they can just get over it. What do you say to those parents?
I've said in many settings that the most important message I feel like parents or loved ones need to convey is letting your loved one know that even if you don't understand, even if you're annoyed with them or disappointed, but that you're there to help. And that when you don't know, you will be willing to ask, right? Now we have much better resources and information available than we ever did, like say 20 years ago when I started in this field. And a lot of it is available in different languages. So that's really important. That also wasn't available, you know, a while ago. We have more and more AAPI providers, and importantly, family and community members now speaking openly about their experiences. And I think that is so valuable, you know, just like what you're doing, to let people know, like, oh, we're not alone in this at all.
Right. Yeah.
Because this, that stigma and that, like, wanting to present like a good face is actually very detrimental to people realizing, like, oh, this is actually a thing and other people experience this. And actually there are different treatments I could try out and pick one.
Right. Well, you know, do you believe if there were more Asian American professionals in the mental health care field, it would help lower the stigma around mental illness and how families look at it?
There have clearly been many families I know who came and sought me out, for example, because they felt like they would be less judged. They wouldn't have to spend time explaining things. Of course, sometimes cultural and language access is a big issue too.
Right.
I am a bilingual therapist, and for a lot of, especially older generation, that's needed. Yeah. And then it already has made a difference because, like I said, having providers, researchers, and community members speaking openly about all of our shared experiences really normalizes that. Like, this is just part of a health journey. And statistically, you know, at some point in life, a huge percentage of us will go through mental health stress or illness for at least a period, just like any other illness. And so let's really talk openly about how do people treat this?
I love it. Thank you so much. You've really provided me with a lot of great information, and for our listeners. Is there anything else that you would like to add? My apologies. My children are sure. I don't know if you can hear my children here being loud. Oh my gosh.
No, I mean, thank you for, you know, even having the podcast where people can really talk and learn about like all the different ways that we suffer the same and can actually gain from sharing about it, but that also we can be resilient and find ways to heal.
Helen, thank you again for joining me. That was Helen Hsu, psychologist, Asian American specialist, and lecturer at Stanford University. For more information about today's guest, please visit atstpodcast.com. That's the letter A, tstpodcast.com. There you can find more information about her, her social media handles, and other resources. Thank you for being a part of the conversation. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and you've been listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. Take care.